Welcome to Ely Pits and Meadows. This podcast can be used as a guided walk around the Ely Pits and Meadows, designated as a site of special scientific interest, but can be enjoyed as a standalone audio podcast. Ely Pits and Meadows is a tranquil area on the eastern edge of Ely. It has been brought to life here by the local people who know and love the area and whose memories and stories go back to the 19th century. Memories that range from very recent wildlife sightings to the fossil memories within the land itself. We'll hear stories about the Second World War, agriculture, and digging for clay during the 1947 floods, plus reminiscences of childhood in the area. This walk begins at the top of Kiln Lane, close to Prickwillow Road, postcode CB74TX. If you look to the side of the road, you should see a large map of the area that we'll be walking around. It crosses both commons, taking in the disused clay pits, often known as Roswell Pits, before reaching Cuckoo Bridge. Along the way, you'll see some stunning views of Ely Cathedral, the Ship of the Fens. So, let's start our walk, remembering to look out for hazards such as oncoming cars and later in our journey, trains. Looking down Kiln Lane, turn right onto the small footbridge that takes us onto Milking Hill Common. Once you're on the common, take the path to the left. This area has seen significant changes from agriculture to defensive use during World War II, with the building of a tank trap and a defensive structure known as a pillbox. But local man John Lupson remembers the common as a place to play.
But the common itself, that was always full of children in the summer, with the kale parsley and hide and seek in the kale parsley all the way down.
In spring, the common is exquisite, a riot of cow parsley and horse chestnut flowers, but at other times it may be hidden by long grass or hay. During World War II and the threat of invasion, the common became part of the country's defence against potential invaders. Keep walking until you see the second tree in the centre of the common, and on your left, if you look closely, you will see a tree growing out of a block of masonry covered by vegetation. The pillbox, where guards would have been stationed, watching out for advancing troops. Richard Braund tells of the pillbox's conversion into a bat hibernaculum.
The pillbox on the common. It was a World War II defensive system. An expert opinion says that the pillbox is a 23A model with additional reinforcement and would have contained an anti-tank gun. In 2011, we had approval to convert the pillbox to use as a bat hibernaculum, a place for bats to hibernate through the winter. We cleaned out the pillbox, secured it with a metal door, and created cavities using bricks and timber. There are up to 5 species of bat found at Roswell Pits, and we're hopeful that in a few years, some of them at least, will occupy the pillbox during the winter.
Head back towards the top of Kiln Lane. Under your feet is the site of another of Ely's defences, a huge ditch which served as a tank trap. A boy at the time, Dudley Coleridge, describes its location.
That's where the tank trap started, about 50 yards down towards Furnaces Road. And then they went all the way along till I think they ended up around about the old orchard, because there was water then down there, so tanks could not come in from the east without going into the tank trap.
The traps were formidable obstacles.
But they're very steep, which I think the idea was that if a tank could run up one and it go down, it'd be stuck in the bottom, it couldn't get out. That was obviously the idea of it. I'm sure it would have worked well if they were daft enough to drive into it.
In 1945, Italian prisoners of war who were based in Ely were drafted in to fill in the tank trap. At the end of the common, turn right to walk down Kiln Lane. It was here that as a young boy, George Reynolds saw some exciting activity in the skies.
Our main occupation was watching aircraft, because there were so many of them over here. We used to go out late in the evening and when they were doing 1,000 bomber raids, and we would be counting the planes. I did once see a Messerschmitt. The pilot, in fact, waved to us. Brilliant summer's day. Again, we'd be down near the pits, on the road actually to Adelaide. And he was very low. He was obviously having a look around. And he just put his hand up and waved.
As we walk down Kiln Lane, pause on the bridge over Roswell Pits to look at one of the best views of Ely Cathedral. The innovative engineering techniques required to build the famous octagon mark it out as one of the most important medieval buildings in the whole of Europe.
If you notice right towards the EA pit, the far end, there's quite a steep bank. That's how it was. Not quite as steep as that, but it was a rolling hill, which I should think went probably almost as far as the bridge, where the bridge is now, before it became flat land. They grazed cattle on that. That's where the cowslips used to grow.
But when the pit was dug, it revealed fantastic geological evidence. Geologist Peter Hoare explains.
Geology that we're interested in, or many of us are anyway, in the Ely district is the Kimmeridge clay, and it's from that Kimmeridge clay that so much material was removed in those, or from those borrow pits, in order to strengthen the banks of the various drainage courses in this part of the fens. The Kimmeridge clay in this area is something like 50 metres thick. It was deposited in a relatively shallow, relatively warm sea during the Jurassic period of geological time. A huge range of fossils have been collected from the Kimmeridge clay, principally during the 19th century, when it was the subject of so much attention from principally Cambridge geologists. But we find things like ammonites, bivalves, brachiopods, crinoids, foraminifera, which are microfossils, and of course, most spectacular of all, marine reptiles like ichthyosaurs.
The terrible winter of 1947 caused extensive flooding across the fens as rivers and drainage dikes burst their banks, engulfing whole villages. Clay from the pits was taken by water and road to repair the damage. Roger Newstead remembers it vividly.
Yes, it was a very disturbing time. We'd never, and indeed my parents had never experienced floods on that magnitude before. And it was really all hands to the pumps. I was at the King's School. Our term was finished early, our Lent term, and we were, all the boarders were sent home and classes finished. And the school dormitories were used for people who had lost their homes, and some, I believe, for servicemen who were drafted in to help. And as I say, it was all hands to the pumps, literally. I recall, I believe they were German prisoners of war helping down at the pits. We also had Italian prisoners of war in Ely, but I think most of them had gone home by that time. I recall going down to Ely High Bridge and watching one of the tugs towing a string of barges, and he got caught underneath the bridge, and they had to take the funnel down so that he could actually get through, and it was desperately urgent that he could get through because he'd got a string of barges behind him all laden. The water, if I remember correctly, was about halfway up Victoria Street. The Cutter public house was more or less isolated. Way down in Springhead Lane, the water was across the marshes up to Springhead Lane, and it froze for a while, and I can recall an impromptu game of ice hockey which we played on the sort of washland there. But it really was actually quite a frightening time for a lot of people.
And so does John Lupson.
Well, my grandfather was, as I say, sorry, foreman in 1947 floods, and he had a lot to do with it. And he was awarded the MBE for the work that he'd done in the 1947 floods.
As you continue down the hill, picture scores of local children using the area as a giant playground.
So I suppose my fondest memory was fishing there with another. I remember it was a boy, but I can't remember who it was with me. And we'd gone in there fishing, which we didn't do much, because I don't know whether it was private fishing, but it felt like we shouldn't be there. And we went fishing there one day, and I got this fish on the end of my rod. And of course, considering being brought up the river, we fished every day. I mean, it was just what we did. I remember getting this bite on this fish on the end of my rod, and it felt like nothing I'd ever felt before. I thought I got a whale on the end. And literally I was struggling with this thing and feeling like it was going to pull me in. And the boy that was with me, who would have been, I suppose we'd have been about 10-ish, about the same age, he kind of got hold of me and the rod as well. And we were struggling away, and we still couldn't make it come. I guess we probably weren't very skilled. And We were panicking, really. I didn't want to let go of my rod, which seemed like an option, but it was my, you know, expensive. Well, it weren't expensive, but to me, mother would have killed me. And yet we couldn't get it in, and we felt like it was going to pull us in the water. And just at that moment, or after a while, my art teacher walked by. I don't know whether we've got a dog or what, I can't remember. Mr. Walker, he was my art teacher. I said, Mr. Walker. And he came and helped us land this, what turned out to be a 6-pound pike, which I think is quite big. It certainly felt huge. Yes. It was like a whale at the time to us. And he helped us land this pike, and I remember that he ran home and got his camera and took a picture of me and this boy holding this pike. So So that's a really that was the biggest fish I ever caught.
As you walk down the hill, you will see the railway line ahead of you and a large oak tree on your right with a gate to its left. This was a medieval route known locally as Lover's Lane, which led from Ely to the monastic farm at nearby Turbotsey. The wooded area of Lover's Lane could make an interesting detour and is a good place to see small mammals, such as stoats, foxes and rabbits. We're now going to cross the railway line, so please take care as you do this. We will reconvene on the opposite side, next to the gate on the right. The field we can see beyond the gate is an important breeding site for lapwings. Richard Braund recounts the work done to improve the habitat for the birds.
The wet meadow that you're looking at beyond the metal gate has been a breeding site for lapwings for a number of years. To reduce disturbance by dogs, we filled the gaps in the hedgerow along the riverside footpath with native hedge plants, and with the farmer we've erected a fence. We put up signs during the breeding season pointing out to the public that lapwings breed in the meadow and asking them to keep their dogs under control.
And Liz Hunter remembers watching the lapwings protect their young.
One evening we saw a performance in the lapwing field that could have been nature red in tooth and claw had the lapwings not been so plucky. As we were hoping to see the barn owl, we'd stopped and looked at the lapwings and suddenly were aware of the barn owl gliding silently over the field and curving down towards the lapwing chicks. The adult lapwings were up in a trice and roundly saw the owl off. As the owl flew away, a grey heron hove into view and the lapwings flew up again and attacked the heron until he also left. As they settled themselves down, the barn owl returned on this beautiful white glide, and the lapwings flew up yet again and saw the barn owl off the premises. What could have been carnage was just an enormous amount of hard work on the part of the adults.
Dudley Coleridge tells us how the river washes provided a treat for Sunday tea.
And the Cresswells at the bottom, the name comes from Cresswells, I believe, doesn't it?
Yeah, because we used to get stacks of watercress down there. There was several dykes there that were much cleaner than what they are today, because they used to get flooded and get fresh water in every now and again, plenty of rainwater. And there was lovely watercress.
Yeah.
Just take it home and wash it over Sunday tea.
Continue along Kiln Lane until you pass the buildings on your right. The riverside meadows, often known as the washes, have provided rich grazing for dairy cattle for centuries. Peter Lee tells us how generations of his family farmed the area.
We would take the cattle from Butts Farm, which is along the Lynn Road, where I was born, down to the washland in the spring and fetch them away in the autumn. Each time we moved them, we would have to take one or two really old cows with us to lead the way across the railway. The younger ones just wouldn't face it. So I had one or two old cows to do that. otherwise no way could you get the younger cattle to cross. 1945, my dad and eldest brother Roy would take a milk float to the sharp bend on Prickwiller Road and travel straight across to the railway line. At this time, no gold had been taken from this area. Brother Roy was not pleased, as he had to get out of the trap to undo the gates. At that time, we would milk 16 cows by hand on the wash field, pouring the milk through a strainer into the 10-gallon milk churns.
The buildings mark what has always been the working part of the area. There was once a blacksmith shop here, and now the industrial buildings include the Environment Agency's workshops and yards. Andrew Bullivant from the Environment Agency recounts some of the changes.
Some of these buildings are owned and operated by the Environment Agency. Ely Depot is the largest facility in the area and has been providing key support to operations in the Great Ouse River system for many decades. What you see is a collection of modern buildings which replace timber structures of the past. It is in a strategic position on the Great Ouse with good river access and an abundance of clay. In the early days, boats and barges were built here. There was also a blacksmith's building. The barges were mainly used to transport clay from the adjacent Roswell pit to repair and build flood embankments. A variety of engineering work was carried out, including servicing and repairs to excavators and machinery, construction of sluice gates and general engineering tasks. The depot was at its busiest in the 1950s to 1960s, following the 1947 floods, when major works were carried out to provide improved flood defence in the Fen and rivers around Ely. During this period, the depot is one of the largest employers in the area. Although still busy, large fabrication work is no longer performed here, and many of the existing buildings are used by other engineering businesses.
A few yards further along, directly in front of you, there is a gap in the fence and a path that leads to Cuckoo Bridge. Perhaps the most attractive stretch of the river, with willows, reed beds, and lovely views across the man-made fen landscape. The bridge you will soon see replaced a wooden one that swayed precariously in the wind. Cuckoo Bridge is so called because on a quiet day and with a good dose of luck, you can hear a cuckoo. With even more luck, you may see one of the bitterns who breed nearby. Bitterns are one of the rarest and shyest of British birds, and their presence here is one of the reasons the site has officially been designated a site of special scientific interest. Bittern sightings are extremely rare, but here Liz Hunter remembers catching sight of this reclusive bird.
In one of the bitterly cold winters, we were standing on Cuckoo Bridge, and my husband was looking through his binoculars at an array of water birds. And suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something moving, and it was exactly the same colour as the dried reeds. And I realised, having seen photographs, that it was the underside of a bittern that actually flew over Cuckoo Bridge as we were standing on it, and it circled round in front of the island so that we could see its beautiful patterns on its back, did a complete circuit, and then went down into the reeds. And so perfect was its camouflage, we couldn't see it again.
And Sarah Blakeman recalls another.
We were walking with Billy, our black Labrador, and decided to go right up to the bank for a change. And as we were just walking along, Jonah suddenly said, Mum, I think that's a bittern. So we stopped and looked, and sure enough it was. So we then quickly got on our mobile phone to ring Andrew and Ben to come and join us. And they confirmed that, yes, it really was a bittern hidden in the reeds on the other side of the river. It was really exciting for us. It's the first time I've seen a bittern so close in Ely.
The bitterns spend most of their time in settling ponds across the river, as Richard Braund now explains.
The reed bed by Cuckoo Bridge is managed by the Wildlife Trust and has been a breeding site for marsh harriers. Further along the footpath across the River Great Ouse are the settling lagoons of the former beet sugar factory. The reed beds here have for a number of years supported 2 to 3 pairs of breeding marsh harriers, and most years bittern have wintered here and have been heard booming in the spring, although there's no evidence that they have bred.
Otters are returning to the Great Ouse River, and there have been many recorded sightings at the pits, including one recorded by Daryl Graham.
But down on the wash as well, seeing most of them, and you're up close, and it's just nice to see them playing about, seeing a mother and child in the snow playing there, which has been good.
So they come out onto the bank?
They have come onto the bank, yeah. But that's been during the day as well, probably out of snow. So it's not always in the evenings, I think, anywhere is quiet.
From Cuckoo Bridge, we head back towards the top of Kiln Lane. In a moment, on the right, you'll see a boat dock and the Environment Agency's small pit where old barges are moored. These are similar to the ones that transported clay to mend the flood-ravaged dikes in 1947. The barges remind us of the fragility of the Fenlands and their reliance upon man-made drainage systems. Continue walking. Kingfisher often nest in the banks here, and the bridge under the railway played an entertaining part in children's lives. Ben Green shares his kingfisher stories.
Can be in certain years really good for kingfishers, and they obviously fare better in good weather, and some of the harsh winters we've had have knocked them back a bit. So, but they recover every now and again. You'll hear them sort of piping the little whistling calls, and then you'll see a flash of blue as they skid past you and disappear into the overhanging bushes. They'll build nests in little nooks and crannies, and sometimes even some of the fishing stations where they've built bare sloping muddy banks. I saw one kingfisher try and nest in there at one stage.
And John Lopson also has childhood reminiscences.
A lot of the people who, or young lads and girls as well, from what we call Chinatown, the New Barnes Avenue, was taught to swim there off the timbers, which used to guide the barges through the railway bridge. And there used to be quite a crowd down there some evenings. We used to have to walk from a Kiln Lane railway crossing along the side of the railway and just climb over the fence. And that's where they used to swim, a lot of them. In those days, food wasn't short, but I used to go catch it, to catch gudgeon on a Friday or in the week, and then Saturdays me and my father would go out into the pits, the yachting club pit, and put deadlines in for eels, and we used to tie them to the old Corona bottles, and then on the Sunday we'd go out and pick them up and see what we'd got. And also springtime, when the ducks were nesting, we used to have ducks' eggs, and the pits used to be full of coots in them days, but there's none about there now. And also coots' eggs, but we never used to take all of them, only one or two out of probably 10 or 15.
The floating reed beds were installed by Natural England, and Ely Wild Space obtained a grant for the tern raft, which has had lots of interest, but as yet, no tern occupants. As you cross back over the railway lines and pause at the first sizeable clearing in the trees, on your right, you'll see the largest of the Roswell pits. Clay may well have been dug here in medieval times. The sacrist, who ran the monastic farm at the time, made and sold tiles, and there is evidence in the area of a medieval kiln. When the pits were first dug on a commercial scale, Roger Newstead's great-grandfather was the first superintendent. Inspired by a photo of his great-grandfather, Roger tells a family story that links the clay pits with the cathedral.
This is a photograph which shows my great-grandfather, William Dew. He was the superintendent at Roswell Pits, which meant that he was in effect sort of works manager or foreman equivalent today. And his job was to set the men to work, to count the number of barges of galt which were sent out, and generally maintain the property and the premises and the equipment that they used. And the picture shows him actually cutting reeds. It has been misclassified in the past as cutting osiers, but if you look carefully, they are bundles of reeds that he's cutting and putting into the barge alongside. Those reeds were basically used for thatching. Although in, I think it's the month of October, St. Etheldreda's Day, he used to load them onto his donkey cart and take them up to the cathedral, and they used to lay them on the floor of the nave.
He goes on to talk about early clay digging.
Most of the clay that's been excavated there has been used to raise the riverbanks. And it used to go out by barge. The various fen farmers in each area of Fenland formed a drainage board, and the drainage boards would buy from Roswell Pits. Oh. And one of my great-grandfather's jobs and my grandfather's job was to keep a tally of how many barge loads went out to each of the drainage boards. Now, unfortunately, my great-grandfather couldn't read or write, but his wife Jane could. So Jane used to do the accounting.
Three generations of John Lupson's family worked in the area for a total of 128 years and 6 months.
My grandfather started digging the pits by hand and putting in the lighters and taking it out to put on the river banks. And I think they used to puddle it in them days, dig a hole in the top of the bank, put the clay in, water it and puddle it and tread it in with the feet. I did see it in one book that they used to call them puddle trenches, and they used to do it by the feet.
Continue to the bridge for another view across the large pit, whilst we listen to Shirley Merry, wife of eel catcher Sid Merry, remembering how her husband used to catch eels here.
And he used to put them in the river, and he never marked on the river anywhere where he put them. He used to know every blade of grass. along the river and in the pits, because he never put a marker, because he said if you put a marker in, everyone will know where your nets are.
The preparation of the eels was a simple task.
What they used to do in the fen is just boil them with onion, chopped onion, and just boil them up in water, and then you serve them hot. Mind you, they're lovely smoked.
Otters are sometimes seen in the big pit. Andrew Bamford tells of an occasion when slow picking lost out to otter watching.
The first time I saw an otter, in fact the only time I've seen an otter in Ely, was it was very late in October in 2006. And I remember it very distinctly because I'd been meaning to get some sloes to make sloe gin. I was waiting for the frosts, and then a friend at work told me, you don't have to wait for the frosts to make the sloes porous enough to make the gin. You just have to bring them home, pick them when they're ripe, and then freeze them. And then they'll work just as well. And it was a great year for sloes. I wanted to get out and pick some. And it was last thing in October, October evening, last night of the day, and we were coming down the bridge between the two pits, all four of us, and my children and my wife, and saw these very obvious big ripples right in the middle of the main pit, and thought, that's a dog swimming, it's enormous. And then looked closer with binoculars and realised it was a dog otter. And we sat and watched it for a good 5 minutes as it was ambling around before the light more or less completely faded. By the stage, of course, we'd forgotten to go and collect the sloes. And that's when I really realised what a special place Roswell was.
Continue up the hill to the second half of the common, where local man Frank Richards spotted something that could have changed the local landscape forever.
I was walking one of our dogs at the time and used the commons and Kiln Lane on a fairly regular basis. And in the winter of that year, I noticed work had started on and around the pits. And I was absolutely horrified at what was happening, and I couldn't really understand how it had been allowed. It was a clearance of scrub mainly, and making roadways, for want of a better word, where only sort of footpaths existed before. And trees were being cut down almost willy-nilly at the time.
This action was a rallying call for the people of Ely. And after a public meeting, Ely Wild Space Group was formed. It now has over 1,000 members. Liz Hunter remembers the beginnings of the movement.
Most important, I think, early on, was the meeting we had in the city of Liverpool, where we had what we thought we might get 100 people, and we couldn't contain ourselves because it began to fill up and fill up and fill up. And in the end, when we had more than 400 people in, we had to turn away possibly another 100 people. And it was then that we realised that although LCPRE was a very small committee, there was a huge backing from the people of Ely for what we were doing. And I think that gave us tremendous enthusiasm to carry forward and to get legal protection.
Members were concerned that trees were being felled, services installed and hard standing put in place in preparation for a marina with moorings for narrow boats. Ely Wild Space took legal advice and worked with Natural England and the Wildlife Trust to protect the area. The site of special scientific interest was extended to protect the pits and the settling ponds for the assemblage of wetland birds and bitterns, as well as preserving the fossil records. At the top of Kiln Lane, turn right into Cowslip Common. In 2014, after two public inquiries, lots of fundraising and a Supreme Court judgment, Ely Wild Space was able to secure town green status for the whole of the common, ensuring that it can be used for lawful uses and pastimes in perpetuity. Work is taking place to improve the wildflower meadow. Orchids have recently returned, and adder's tongue fern is growing here.
First time I found a bee orchid on the common, that was really nice. I can't remember where I was walking to or from school. I suspect it's probably back from school. And just in the corner of the common, this little bright pink and purple thing. I thought, what's that going on over there? And it was a bee orchid. And you think, well, you know, you read about orchids and you think, well, that's surely they're not that common. And they probably aren't that common. But to have that just suddenly appear out the corner of my eye, that's, again, it's just amazing what springs up.
Continue your walk to the end of this common for another stunning view, this time from Ely Sailing Club. Roger Newstead's great-grandparents' cottage was on the bend of this common, but nothing remains of it now, as the cliff edge has over time crumbled into the water. Roger's great-grandmother was famous in the area for her homemade wines.
My great-grandmother and my grandmother, I mean, she followed in the family tradition, absolutely lethal brews of wheat and barley and sugar beet, elderberry, almost anything she could make wine from. And she did a wheat wine which was almost crystal clear and had absolute knockout properties. And you would go down to the shed at the bottom of her garden where she used stoneware bottles from the brewery, sort of half-gallon things, which she stored the wine in to let it mature. And as it matured, of course, the gas would build up and blow the corks out, and they would come out with quite a bang, I can tell you.
The tradition continues today. Blackberries, sloes, apples, small plums, known locally as bullaces, elderberries for wine, and elderflowers for cordials. They are all picked from the common. When the site achieved town green status, it was celebrated with common cake, containing apples and blackberries from Cowslip Common. Pause at the side of Ely Sailing Club. Beyond this building, established in 1946, there were other pits, including one known as the Blue Lagoon. They have all been filled in.
What we call the Blue Lagoon. Blue clay, and we got the light on it, and it was like Hawaii, and it was clear, because it was only all rainwater and water that didn't come from anywhere, you know, it was just confined to that one area. It didn't mix with the river water or anything. And it was very, very, very clear. Mm. Quite a lot of weed in there, but we swam in there too. Yeah, but the reason I think it was considered a hazard, I think it was a King School lady, I don't know, drowned in there.
When Ben Green saw great white egrets arrive on this pit, it brought in twitchers from far and wide, and it underlined why Ely Pits and Meadows is so special for so many people.
One winter a few years ago where great egrets suddenly appeared, and they came into roost on a sort of small little islandy bit with tall trees, I didn't expect that. I know that Little Egrets have been, they've been increasing in numbers over the last 10-15 years, but Great Egrets are still relatively rare in this country, although they are increasing. And suddenly to have them on your own doorstep was quite an amazing sight. Again, I wasn't looking for them. I just happened to look up and thought, oh blimey, that's a big egret. It's obviously not a little egret, it's a great egret, and I thought perhaps it would just, you know, fly over, but no, it settled in the trees, and then a few minutes later another one did, and that provided a lot of entertainment for a few weeks in the winter. And we had all sorts of people turn up and arrive at just before dusk, and they stood waiting, and it was like a proper feeding time at the zoo situation, where you get people turning up expecting the show, and it happens, and the birds come in, and you're never quite sure which direction they were going to come from, and they, just before dark, they drop in and settle down into the trees.
We hope you have enjoyed this sound picture of rural Ely. We have been delighted by the range of memories and stories that people have generously shared with us, and thank them all. Their testimonies tell the important story of how the land has sustained the life of the local community, providing pastime and pleasure and foraged food, how it has protected the community from flood and threats of invasion. If you would like to know more about Ely Pits and Meadows, see photographs of both past and present, or listen to the wealth of extended interviews, please go to Ely Pits and Meadows website at memoriesofelypitsandmeadows.com. Thanks must also go to Matt Hill, who produced this podcast, recordists Andrew and Pam Bullivant, John and Liz Hunter, Ben Baxter for editing the interviews, and to the Heritage Lottery Fund, whose support has made it all possible. Thank you and goodbye.